Welcome to Tune to Two Yesterday, broadcasting shows from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. Coming up in this hour, Bob Hope hosts the story of the atomic bomb, an unlikely broadcast for him, but an educational and informative one, from July of 1950 on NBC. We'll hear from newsman Robert Trout, also a writer for the New York Times, who was led behind the scenes of the making of the A-bomb, Bill Lawrence. Also, stay tuned for, after the broadcast, a Bob Hope extra. This NBC broadcast called The Quick and the Dead.
The Quick and the Dead. The NBC News and Special Events Department present the spectacular document for ear on the atomic bomb under the direction of Fred Friendly.
This is Bob Hope. You see this piece of white shiny metal about the size of, say, a package of cigarettes? You see this piece in my other hand about the same size? Together they weigh, oh, a few pounds. Both are hunks of uranium. Now I take one and gently I tap it against the other. Now hold on to your seats. That's an atomic explosion, just like the one that blew up Hiroshima. Two pieces of ore, and you bang them together, and you can destroy a city. Why? What has man done to these two pieces of metal? Now, you're probably leaning back and saying to yourself, what on earth is Hope doing talking about atomic energy? What does he know about physics? And you'd be right. I didn't even know what fission meant. Don't let that last word scare you. Fission is simply atom language for explosive. Or that an atom is so small that there are over a billion of them in every drop of water. That is until 3 weeks ago. I happened to look at my income tax form and I realized that I was a very big taxpayer and I knew that an awful big part of that tax was going toward atomic energy plants, of which I knew less than nothing. So one day I figured as long as I'm financing this project, I ought to kind of check up on things. So when I was in New York, I was sitting around chatting with some of the boys in the newsroom and then we got around to the atom. I told the boys I felt like a rube not knowing more about the subject and asked them to give me a quick once-over.
This is Bob Trout in the newsroom. Let me tell you about Mr. Hope and how he became NBC's unofficial atomic expert. At first, we thought Hope was kidding when he said he wanted to get a little tutoring on atomic energy, and we told him to go see some scientists like Einstein or Oppenheimer or Compton.
No, that's not the kind of guy for me to talk to. I wouldn't know what they were talking about. I need a guy that talks atom like Bill Coram or Red Smith writes baseball.
Then, Bob, the man for you to see is Lawrence.
Who?
Bill Lawrence of the New York Times. He's their science reporter, a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and the only reporter allowed backstage at the building of the bomb. You go see Lawrence and tell him the boys in the newsroom sent you over.
So what was I going to do? I'd asked for advice, so I had to at least make some kind of a gesture toward following it. I called Lawrence, and he told me to stop by for a drink. I walked east to his apartment on 72nd Street down by the river, climbed the 4 floors to his apartment, and knocked.
Come in, Mr. Hope.
I was a little surprised. He certainly didn't look like a hot reporter or my idea of a Pulitzer Prize winner. He was medium height, about 55 or so, with a rather thoughtful face and a slight accent. A little European and a little Harvard, I learned later. Sat me down by a window, asked me quite a few questions about Hollywood and Bing Crosby. Then this guy told me the darndest detective story I ever heard. I got so much out of it, I thought I'd like to share Bill Lawrence's story with you.
It wasn't really my story. It was man's story. And perhaps the biggest news story of the 20th century. I was privileged to be tapped on the shoulder by the Army and given the assignment that every newspaperman dreams of.
Mr. Lawrence, we want you to work for us for a few months. It'll be on a highly secret, and it'll be a very important program.
The general was Leslie R. Groves of the Corps of Engineers.
We can't tell you where you're going. All we can say is that you come to Washington and start to work. It's an important story. Maybe. It's a story that we only want one man working on, and you are the man.
Well, needless to say, Bill, you accepted General Groves' offer. Before you go into the business of how they discovered, then made the bomb, I wondered if you would mind going right to the last chapter of the story first and telling me about the first atomic bomb you ever saw go off.
The first atomic blast I ever saw was the first one that man had ever seen. On July 16, 1945, a caravan of scientists in buses and trucks moved along Route 380 in the New Mexico desert. Through sleepy little towns like Los Lunas, Belen, and Bernardo, into the Sierra Oscura mountain range. There, near an abandoned reservoir at Alamogordo, The titanic labors of our scientists were to be tested.
Attention! Zero hour! Minus 45 seconds!
A voice rang out somewhere in the black darkness and filled the night. It was almost 5:30 in the morning. A cold drizzle had been falling since midnight, and there was talk that the test might even be called off. On a tower 20 miles away from me, the first atomic bomb waited in its cradle, a $2 billion baby waiting to be born. 5 miles away from the tower that held the bomb, Professor Robert Oppenheimer gave the signal that in a few seconds would set in operation the delicate mechanisms that would release the greatest burst of energy ever before released on Earth. No buttons would be pushed, no switches thrown. A series of robots were already in motion. The drizzle grew harder. A desert coyote howled in the distance for the last time.
0 hour, minus 3 seconds.
And just at that second arose from the bowels of the earth a light not of this world. The light of many suns in one. Don't be upset if you hear no sound. We are 20 miles away, and the sound travels much slower than light. It will be 100 seconds till we hear it. It was a sunrise such as the world had never seen. A great green super sun, climbing in a fraction of a second to a height of 8,000 feet. And then a great cloud rose from the ground and followed the trail of the bright new sun. An enormous cloud in the form of a mushroom, much taller than Mount Everest. I glanced at my watch. The 100 seconds were almost up. The sound of the explosion finally caught up with us. Out of the great silence came a mighty thunder. It was the blast of thousands of blockbusters going off simultaneously at one pinpoint. The thunder reverberated all through the desert and bounced back and forth from the Sierra Oscura mountains. The earth trembled beneath our feet like an earthquake. And as I listened to this great thunder trying to escape from the trap between the mountain ranges, I found myself asking again and again, what has man done to these two pieces of uranium? And how did it happen that this secret had been given to us and not to our enemy? My thoughts went back to 1939. Another man-made cloud had descended on Europe. Adolf Hitler had already swallowed up Austria and Czechoslovakia and had his lightning poised towards Poland. In Italy, Benito Mussolini was too drunk with power to realize what great wealth he lost when he let Dr. Fermi get away from him.
My name is Enrico Fermi. In 1938, I was given the Nobel Award for my work with neutrons and the atom. I had watched Mussolini lead my nation toward fascism and war. And like Maestro Toscanini and others, I knew I had to get out. When I went to Sweden for the award, my family and I left Italy for good.
Dr. Fermi had only been in America a few short weeks when he realized that nothing was being done in the United States about an atomic bomb, and he went to Washington.
In 1939, I asked for an appointment with the Navy Department. I told them that there was reason to believe that an atomic bomb could be built, and that one atom bomb would do the damage of hundreds or thousands of TNT bombs. They listened to me and told me they would think about it. I did not hear from them again.
Now, wait a minute, Bill. Hold everything. What's a neutron? Fermi was given a Nobel Prize for his work with neutrons. What exactly had Fermi done that was so great?
Well, here we have to get into physics for a second, Bob. Let's make it a rule. I'll never give you more than 60 seconds of physics at a time. How's that?
That's a deal. All right, Bill. What's a neutron and what did Fermi do to it?
First, let's take an atom. Everything on Earth is made of atoms. And an atom is the smallest part of any element. You can't make them, and no man had ever been able to destroy them. In one drop of water, Bob, there are 1 billion atoms.
Say that again.
One drop of water, there are 1 billion atoms.
That's what I was afraid you said. Then a dime must have 5 billion atoms in it.
Bob, a dime is made up of more than 2 million billion atoms.
Whew. Then what's a neutron?
Don't get ahead of me. Every atom has a nucleus, a hard center, so to speak.
Oh, and I suppose a nucleus is about one-third the size of the tiny atom.
Bob, the nucleus is 1/100,000th the size of the atom. And inside that nucleus is what we call the neutron.
At last. And what does the neutron do for a living?
No one knew it did anything. Until an Englishman named Chadwick discovered it in 1932. And then Dr. Fermi discovered that these tiny neutrons within the nucleus of the infinitesimal atom were actually bullets that could be fired out to split other atoms.
Uh-oh. Minute's up. Let's move on.
All right, Bob. A deal is a deal. Let's go on with the story. Our next key witness is a woman, a German woman.
My name is Lise Meitner. It wasn't easy to leave Germany at my age. Nor was it easy to leave my experiments at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute.
If you were to see Lise Meitner on the streets of Berlin in the late 30s, you would have observed a rather plain woman in her early 60s. If she appeared a little preoccupied and absent-minded, it was because this woman was on the verge of opening the door to one of nature's most guarded secrets. In 1938, the Gestapo forced her out of a laboratory and out of Germany because she was a non-Aryan.
As my train crossed the border and thundered across the flat Holland marshes toward my refuge in Denmark, my mind kept going back to certain recent tests that I had been making with uranium ore. I had been bombarding uranium with neutrons, and to my amazement was getting barium out of it. This seemed impossible. At first, I thought I had used mixing vessels which had been used previously for barium. I got clean ones and started again. Still, I was getting barium out of uranium. Why? Then suddenly a strange thought struck me. Uranium has 92 protons. Barium has 56. The difference is 36. What has 36 protons? Krypton has 36. Could it be that I was getting krypton along with my barium? I could scarcely wait to check this when I arrived in Denmark. If it was so, it could mean but one thing. Without knowing it, I had been splitting uranium atoms. Could such a thing be possible?
The fact that Lise Meitner had gotten barium out of uranium wasn't important in itself. The important thing was that she had taken the tightly clenched atom, holding itself together from the time the world began, and in gently forcing nature's hand open. This woman had unleashed an energy equal to 200 million volts. all from one single atom of uranium.
Oh, that's a wonderful story, Bill. Well, in as early as 1939, we knew how to build a bomb.
No, Bob. Far from it.
Well, what was the hitch then? You said Meitner split the atom. I thought that...
Yes, but Lisa Meitner split only one atom at a time. Just like getting one spark at a time. That hardly equals a fire. How do you build a fire at home, Bob?
With a match.
That's right. And what starts it all?
A spark, I guess.
Exactly. But a spark is only the beginning. It has to start a series of other little fires. And they, in turn, start a series of still other little fires.
Mm-hmm. You call that a chain reaction, don't you?
Right. Well, Robert, one split atom is just one solitary spark. Lisa Meitner had given us that spark. Now the scientists of the world set to work to find a way to keep that spark alive by having it start a series of chain reactions.
To those of us who had fled from Europe, it appeared almost certain that Hitler's scientists knew as much as we did. Could the democracies be made to realize the danger which we scientists saw in our oscilloscopes? Our only chance was getting Professor Einstein to see Roosevelt.
In the fall of 1939, Professor Albert Einstein wrote the following letter to the President of the United States.
Dear President Roosevelt, some recent work by A. Fermi and L. Szilard leads me to expect that uranium may be turned into a new and important source of energy in the immediate future. This new phenomenon would also lead to the construction of bombs, and it is conceivable, though much less certain, that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. I understand that Germany has actually stopped the sale of uranium from the Czechoslovakian mines that she has taken over.
And a short time later, the Navy transferred the sum of $6,000 to our scientists.
Less than 1 month later, Hitler sent his blitzkrieg against Europe, then the collapse of France, and the miracle that was Dunkirk and Britain standing alone. And at long last, Mr. Churchill.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
And one of Mr. Churchill's first decisions as Prime Minister had to do with the atomic energy program. Britain agreed to send its best scientists to the United States. Our intelligence department told us that the German program was well underway. Late in 1941, our top scientists called a council of war. Could a bomb be built in time? Secretary of War Henry Stimson, who helped to make the final decision, along with FDR and General Marshall, called it
a gamble, but as necessary in war, a calculated risk. We decided to go ahead.
Our chips were finally in the pot, 2 billion of them. The date was December 6th.
December 7th, 1941. A date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
I remember that day, all right. But, Bill, I still don't see what we had to gamble on. We still didn't know if we could get that one split atom to start that chain reaction you were talking about.
Exactly. So immediately, three great research centers were set up. One at Columbia, one at Chicago, and one at California. All were vital, but I guess the Chicago mission was the most dramatic.
Arthur Compton, I was at Chicago with Fermi and Szilard. Our job was to build a pile of uranium and see if we could get that chain reaction going. Actually, you might say, it was an atomic bomb in miniature.
My name is Rentschler, Director of Research, Westinghouse. One day, early in 1942, Dr. Compton called me and asked me how soon we could deliver 3 tons of pure uranium to him. We had been experimenting slightly with uranium and had assembled the enormous amount of a few grams by then, about as much as 3 dimes. But Dr. Compton said that it was vital to the war, and so we went to work. In November 42, I was able to wire Compton and say that the 3 tons of pure uranium were on their way to Stagg Field.
Stagg Field? Isn't that where the University of Chicago used to lose all its football games?
That's right. But at Stagg Field, in November of 1942, they were lining up for the most exciting game ever played in any stadium. Beneath the stands of Stagg Field, there were squash courts. A cordon of guards was thrown around the entrance. Even the president of the university was not allowed in, and the most scientific bricklayers in history went to work.
We had but one aim at Stagg Field. We were after that chain reaction. We knew now that uranium was fissionable. We knew that if you put enough of it together, sufficient neutrons would begin bombarding sufficient atoms and forcing out other neutrons, which in turn would go into more atoms. The problem was how much pure uranium did you have to put side by side and on top of itself to get that pile going and still not blow yourself up?
As a nest for their star about to be born, they built a timber framework resting on the lined squash court. And this, they were going to erect a uranium pile in the shape of a cake.
I was one of the bricklayers. Actually, we couldn't lay the uranium one by one beside each other, or the neutrons would have shot out so quickly that we'd have lost them. So we put each piece of pure uranium in a graphite brick to slow down the action. And then slowly we built our pile, brick by brick. 6 tons in all, but ounces at a time.
My job was safety. What we were doing had never been done before. We thought we knew what we were doing, but we also knew that we might accidentally start a premature chain reaction that would in an instant vaporize all the uranium and graphite, blow us sky high, and start a Chicago fire worse than the one Mrs. O'Leary's cow started. So we took precautions. We built 10 slots through the pile, and into these slots we put rods of boron and cadmium. Now, don't let those words scare you. Boron and cadmium are simply metal rods. But for some reason, when neutrons strike them, they devour the neutrons, like cannibals. As long as we had those boron and cadmium rods in there, we were safe. They would act as fire dampers, firewalls, you might say.
Well, with these rods in, how could they get the atomic fire going?
Good point, Bob. They couldn't. But after the pile got near the estimated correct size, Dr. Fermi could give the signal slowly to withdraw the rods. Open the dampers, as we say.
My name is Zinn. I was one of those with his eyes glued on the neutron counters. The census takers, you might say, that told us how many neutrons were being born and how many were dying. On the 23rd day, our counters showed that we were making a lot of neutrons, but just as many were dying. When our instruments registered 1,600, it would mean that we were creating more than we were losing. We'd be in. Remember that figure, 1,600, and we'd be in.
Around midnight, of the 23rd day, one of the coldest nights of that cold Chicago winter, a bunch of weary bricklayers noticed a distinct change in the tempo.
The pile was only 3/4 complete, but with every brick, the speed of the neutron counters seemed to increase.
The next day was December 2nd. By noon, an air of tremendous expectancy and excitement had permeated every inch of the room. There they stood around their baby. Compton, Fermi, Szilard, Zinn, Anderson, and all the others. The counters were increasing their tempo. Within an hour, their first self-sustaining atom chain reaction in the history of man might be a reality. And then Fermi, the imperturbable, looked up from his instruments and said,
"All right, boys, let's go to lunch."
After the most preoccupied lunch in history, the bricklaying continued.
1350.
The last eggs were gently nestled into place.
1370. 1385. 1400.
Intently, we stood watching. Fermi, like a captain docking a great ship, maneuvered the cadmium rods into final position.
Very slowly now, pull out the rods.
1425. 1450.
Zip them out a little more.
On Fermi's signals, we evenly withdrew our fire dampers.
Keep going. Zip them out slowly. Slowly. Slowly.
1500. 1525. 1550. 1570.
That's enough. No more. Hold everything.
1580. 1590. 1600. 1605. 1610. 1620. 1630. 1640.
They had done it. It was 3:30 in the afternoon of December 2nd, 1942. A self-perpetuating chain reaction had taken place. Professor Wigner surprised Fermi and brought forth a bottle of Italian wine he had been hoarding. And a group of tired but excited scientists drank a silent toast to the atomic age out of paper cups. Compton swallowed his quickly, went to his private office and called Dr. Cornett at Harvard to report Fermi's success. Of course, it would have to be a guarded conversation.
Hello, Dr. Cornett. This is Compton in Chicago.
Yes, Arthur. How are things?
Jim, I wish to report that the Italian navigator has arrived in the New World and found the continent much smaller than he thought it was.
Excellent. And I hope the natives received him kindly.
Jim, they couldn't have been more friendly.
At Stagg Field, Chicago, our scientists put enough pure uranium together to get a chain reaction going. A chain reaction meant that an atomic explosion was a distinct possibility. Is that right, Bill?
That's right, Bob.
Okay, let's get on with the bomb.
In the heart of the Tennessee Valley Authority, between the Smokies and the Cumberland Mountains, is Oak Ridge. The local inhabitants, working the worn-out land using methods of the past, were suddenly projected into the 21st century.
My job was security. They called us the Creeps.
That's Colonel Bill Considine.
At Oak Ridge, we had to build magnets, each one about half the size of a city block. We needed copper. almost unlimited copper with which to wind these magnets. And with the war on, there just wasn't that much copper in the world. Silver, as you know, is just as good or even better a conductor of electricity as copper. So we called the mint in Washington and borrowed $400 million worth of silver to wind the magnets with. We moved the silver by flat car, and to this day, those magnets at Oak Ridge are still wound with silver. We used to call it the sub-treasury.
It was the best use any silver was ever put to.
Oh, that's a great story, Bill, but what exactly were they doing at Oak Ridge? Was that the atom bomb factory?
No, Bob. The actual factory was at Los Alamos. Oak Ridge was the source of pure uranium. General Motors, for example, makes cars in Detroit, but they get their steel from Pittsburgh. Oak Ridge had the enormous task of taking the raw uranium and turning it into usable 235 and then shipping it to the factory at Los Alamos to be fabricated into bombs.
All right, Bill, we were on our way. What was holding up the show? We can do anything in America, can't we?
Anything but outwit the sheer cussedness of nature.
What happened?
They suddenly discovered that you can't split all uranium. Only a special kind. Uranium 235.
So, what's the problem? Let's get some uranium 235.
That was the rub. Uranium comes out of the mines mixed with other ores. Black, dirty, and contaminated. Uranium 235 and uranium 238 come together. They're twins, just like Twiddledum and Twiddledee. Shaped alike, look alike, and they go together. They are inseparable.
Oh, now let me get that.
Get this. The scientists discovered that we could use only the lighter one. Only the uranium 235.
But you said they couldn't be separated.
That was why Oak Ridge was built. To do just that job. To get enough pounds of uranium 235 without 238 in it. When we could get a few pounds of that, we could assemble a bomb.
Well, is that where the big magnets come in?
Exactly, Bob. That's why we had to borrow the $400 million worth of silver. At Oak Ridge, General Groves tried Professor Ernest Lawrence's magnetic method, and they also set up a gaseous diffusion method under Professor Dunning of Columbia. If either worked, we would have a bomb. But even that wasn't enough insurance. A third plant was set up at Hanford in the state of Washington.
For making sure we had enough uranium for an atom bomb.
I didn't say uranium, Bob. I said material. At Hanford, they were not making uranium, but plutonium.
Uh-oh. More physics. Go ahead, take 60 seconds.
I can do it in 30, Bob. Plutonium is a derivative of uranium.
Of the precious kind, or can you use the wet kind, the U-238?
238. The kind we have most of, thank the Lord. Professor McMillan, just a youngster, discovered that plutonium also might be used in a bomb. Plutonium is the first element man ever learned to make himself. You take uranium and add one neutron, and it becomes neptunium.
Then what do you do?
Nothing. You leave it alone, and in about 3 days, neptunium turns into plutonium. Just like cider turning into vinegar.
But what about Robert Oppenheimer? I thought he was one of the big shots in this story.
He was, Mr. Hope. But his time had not yet arrived. Oppie, as we called him, was setting up the factory for assembling the bomb at Los Alamos. But in 1943 and 1944, it was still all on paper. They were like soldiers with broomsticks for guns. There still wasn't enough uranium 235 or plutonium to put together a bomb.
And still the millions kept going out.
That's right.
And all this time, all this remained a complete secret.
Those at Oak Ridge didn't know there was a Hanford. Hanford didn't know about Los Alamos. It was already June of 1944, and the war seemed to be passing them by.
General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
People of Western Europe. A landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
And in June of 1944, long before the first uranium or plutonium was shipped to Los Alamos, a special B-29 combat group was activated. Its leader, Colonel Paul Tibbetts, age 29.
Gentlemen, welcome to the 509th and to Wendover Field. As you know, this is a special group. I wish I could tell you something. I can only tell you that we will train and train and train. Someday you will all know why.
At Los Alamos, Professor Oppenheimer and his boys waited for the first purified uranium. And from now on, Bob, when I say uranium, I mean uranium or plutonium. Both were used. Finally, early in 1945, the first cubes, like cubes of sugar, began coming true.
I was a courier. Must have made 30 trips from Oak Ridge to Los Alamos. Never knew what it was I carried in a case strapped to my wrist. Sometimes I went by plane, sometimes by special car, sometimes by train. Wasn't until they dropped the bomb that I knew what I was carrying.
I was one of Oppie's boys. Watched the Wizard of Los Alamos do his job. This was the inner sanctum of the whole deal. Our job was the easiest to explain and the hardest to do. To make a bomb, you simply take some uranium, as pure as possible, and slap two pieces together as quickly as possible. That much we knew. There were only three things we didn't know. One, how much do you have to bring together, a pound or 100 pounds? We call that the critical mass. Two, how to design a container and a trigger mechanism to bring the two hunks of uranium together over the target. And three, how do you hold the two hunks together long enough to get a real explosion and not just a dud?
Oh, now, wait a minute. Hold everything, Bill. What does he mean, hold a bomb together? I thought we wanted to blow it up.
That's right, Bob. But the big problem was this. You slap the two pieces of uranium together, like that. We split an atom, and that starts that chain reaction we've been talking about.
That's right, and we have an atomic bomb.
Correct. But if you want something to take your breath away, just listen to this.
We call our job at Los Alamos extending the generations. The two pieces of uranium come together, there's a chain reaction, they fly apart, and there's an explosion which takes 1 millionth of a second. Get that. 1 millionth of a second. But such an explosion would give us a force equal to only 20 tons of TNT. And you can get that from any ordinary blockbuster.
So, what's the point? We can't spend $2 billion just for a blockbuster. We had those already.
That's right. But listen.
We knew, however, that for every tenth of a millionth of a second more that you can hold those two hunks together, you increase the power of the bomb by 1,000. At Los Alamos, we learned a way to hold it together for that tenth of a millionth of a second longer. And we put together a bomb that could do the work of 20,000 tons of TNT.
Then that timing business is the payoff.
Exactly, Bob. The longer you can hold the two pieces of uranium together, the more efficient a bomb you get. There can be no bigger bombs than those built at Los Alamos. All you can do to improve the bomb is to...
I know. Prolong that millionth of a second that you hold them together.
You astound me, Bob. Absolutely correct. Finally, on July 16, 1945... Los Alamos had enough uranium to make a final test, and the first atom bomb was tested. All that remained now was to slap these two pieces of uranium together over an enemy target. Meantime, uranium was rushed to the cruiser Indianapolis, which hoisted anchor and sailed for Tinian on the very same day as the Los Alamos explosion. Other bomb material, not yet ready, went in three heavy bombers whose pilots were unaware of their cargo. At Potsdam, Germany, couriers brought the news to Truman and Churchill, who told Stalin. On August 5th, the weather reports were favorable. Colonel Tibbetts was finally able to brief his boys.
Well, boys, tonight is the night we've all been waiting for. The bomb we're going to drop is different from any that you've ever heard about. It contains a destructive force equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. Three planes will fly the mission. The Enola Gay to carry the bomb. The primary target is Hiroshima.
That same day, an important change was made in the plan of operations. Some of the Los Alamos scientists and Captain Dick Parsons, whose job it was to load the bomb and set the delicate mechanisms, watched several B-29s crash in takeoff. Parsons went to General Farrell and said,
"General, some of our scientists are quite worried about the possibility of a crash on takeoff with a bomb on board."
"So, Deke, if that happens, we lose the plane, the crew, the bomb, you and the whole darn island. You just pray that that doesn't happen."
"Well, it couldn't happen if I made the final assembly of the bomb in the bomb bay after we take off."
"Deke, have you ever done a final assembly like that before?"
"No, but I've got all day to practice."
"You mean when that plane left Tinian, the bomb wasn't all set?"
"No. And don't think we didn't think of that as we watched the Enola Gay take off and head for Hiroshima. As soon as the mission was airborne, we raced to the communications center where we could talk with Colonel Tibbetts by radio and ask how Parsons was getting on with his assembly job. When we lost contact with the Enola Gay, he was still out in the bomb bay, his skilled fingers working on the delicate trigger mechanism."
"I looked down at my hands. They were dirty, greasy hands, just as if I had fixed the carburetor and distributor of my car."
Bob Lewis, the plane's co-pilot, kept a log of the mission, a priceless document.
"It is 7:30. Parsons has put the final touches on his assembly job. We are now loaded. The bomb is alive. We start to climb to our final altitude at 7:40. Won't be long now. We have now set the automatic pilot for the last time until bombs away. Now it is 8:30. Dick Nelson, our radio operator, has just received a report from one of our weather planes. Hiroshima, our primary target, is clear. We are now ready for the final bomb run. It is 8:50. Not long now. There will be a short intermission now while we bomb our target."
Tom Ferriby, bombardier. "The Enola Gay had a 4-minute run over the perfectly open target. I manipulated the crosshairs of the bomb sight until the target was at the intersection of the course line and the rate line. The great bomb bay door swung open. I synchronized and let go."
The inert mass suspended in the interior came to life, freed itself, leaped out. Still, the two hunks of uranium were at opposite ends of the bomb. Down it hurtled. Eternal seconds passed. It was exactly 9:15, 00. Those inside the plane watched for a signal. Then it came, like a tiny light on a switchboard, a little pinpoint of purplish red light. Oppenheimer's trigger had slapped the two hunks of uranium together and held them so for that tenth of a millionth of a second.
The blue-white flash immediately grew into a giant ball of fire a half mile in diameter.
One of Fermi's neutrons had entered one atom. One atom had forced two neutrons into two more atoms, which gave forth four neutrons in a chain reaction. 2 billion trillion atoms smashed by 2 billion trillion neutrons in that split second.
The mushroom top was a seething, turbulent cloud, which by now was almost at our height. When the blast arrived, we felt the shock waves. There were two short shocks, about 2 seconds apart. It felt like several flak bursts right under the wings.
The bomb did its damage in three ways. First, by blast.
My name is Kleinsorge. I am a Jesuit priest. My mission was in Hiroshima, 1,400 yards from the bomb center. It felt as though the bomb had fallen directly on us. It reminded me of something I had read as a boy, a large meteor colliding with the Earth.
The blast effect alone was equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. Then there was the fire effect.
I was 7 years old at the time, and more than 2,000 yards from the target center. I heard nothing, but when I looked up, I saw a sheet of fire, very, very bright and hot, like a great big sun.
For that split second, it was like a sun. 50 million degrees centigrade, 3 times hotter than the center of the sun. But there was a third kind of death from the bomb, radiation.
My sister and I were 2,000 yards away. My sister seemed quite normal during and after the blast. But a week later, she became sick and suddenly died. Doctor said it was radiation.
We think of radiation as the rays you get from radium. There are less than 5 pounds of radium in all the world. But the radiation effect at Hiroshima was equal to several million tons of radium.
Bill, I'm staggered and bewildered by the whole thing. This was all caused by just a few pounds of uranium being banged together?
Yes, Bob. But here is another fantastic point. The Hiroshima bomb was only partially effective. Less than 1 gram of uranium, weighing less than one dime, actually was split and went into action. 78,000 people died at Hiroshima.
The President of the United States.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans.
The Quick and the Dead, on Tuned to Yesterday from July of 1950, an NBC News special. And we have a couple of moments for a Bob Hope extra. We'll join Hollywood reporter George Fisher from the year of the broadcast we just heard for a few stories from the set of the motion picture Bob Hope was working on at the time, The Lemon Drop Kid. It's George Fisher's Filmtown featurette.
Santa Claus never has gotten the going over he receives in Bob Hope's newest comedy, The Lemon Drop Kid. I dropped in on the Paramount set the other day and watched Bob in 9 Broadway mugs all dressed in the Santa Claus suits. I was lucky enough to watch a pretty hilarious scene. It takes place in a New York saloon with Ski-Nose Hope inspecting his motley crew of bogus Saint Nicks in much the same manner as a general inspects his troops. The Lemon Drop Kid, you may know, is based on a Damon Runyon yarn in which Hope has 23 days, until Christmas Eve, to pay off a $10,000 debt to a gangster. So in desperation, Hope hires several dubious characters, puts them in Santa Claus outfits, and instructs them to go out and pick up money from characters on the Manhattan streets. This is where I came in. Men, says Hope, I'm proud of you. You look splendid. Now, let's nobody be ashamed, because this is a legitimate racket, and we've got a license to collect. Put your heart in your work, just like you would if it was a shady deal. Then Hope, continuing his second lieutenant tactics, passes by each fake Santa Claus, looking them up and down. Pausing in front of one of them, he knocks the stogie from his mouth. Saint Nick don't smoke, Hope explains. But the Santa Claus complains, I thought I was supposed to be Santa Claus. Look stupid, retorts Hope. Santa Claus, Kris Kringle, St. Nick, it's all the same guy. Oh, is the bright reply of the jolly St. Nick. He don't give his right name either. With that comment, Hope walks on in disgust and stops in front of a Kris Kringle played by William Frawley, who is a character called Second Card Tony in the picture. Hope sees that Frawley's stomach is sagging, so he pokes a hand inside the costume and pulls out a pint of whiskey. Frawley protests, but it's cold outside in the streets. Hope remains firm. Santa Claus doesn't drink. Oh, yeah, cracks Frawley. Then how come he's always falling down chimneys? So Hope makes one more inspirational speech to the assorted fakes, and they file out into the street singing Jingle Bells in their cracked, off-key whiskey voices. Those lines I've just repeated are, of course, written into the script. But Bob Hope continues to brighten up every movie with ad-lib comments. For example, the next scene they filmed the day I was on the set, Hope has been jailed for his use of the fake Santas. Marilyn Maxwell has just bailed Bob out of the prison, and Bob takes her arm and starts to leave. As the pair approaches the door, a disheveled, bleary-eyed drunk ambles in on the arm of a policeman. As he walks by, the drunk squints at Hope and mutters a greeting. In the script, the line just calls for Bob to say hello and walk on out. But instead of saying hello, Hope looks at the squinting, bloodshot eyes of the drunk and cracks. What's the matter, kid? Been looking at TV again? When director Sidney Lanfield stopped laughing, he turned to the script girl and ordered the line written into the picture. It's ad-lib lines like these that keep Bob Hope one of the top comedians on the air and on the screen. And that's my Filmtown featurette.
George Fisher from 1950 bringing us a Bob Hope extra. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levine. Thanks for tuning in.